Virat is a lovable boy because, but he's so emotional. And he was like, I was thinking of my teaching days when you had this kid where, you want to kill him 6 times a day, but you also want to give him a hug at the end of the day. And he was that kind of character. And he was always very apologetic because, he's over the line and then you speak to him, I'm sorry, Maria, I'm sorry. But the next ball is there again. So you had to have a bit of patience with him. But yeah, he was very clever that he always, similar to the Aussies who target the best player, he always targeted the best player. And I remember Stokes lost it in Mohali when he chirped him once he was dismissed. And we couldn't hear what Virat said, but Stokes, he was swearing so loudly we had to punish him. That's clever. Just put the bait out.
Welcome to The Biggest Man in Cricket with your host, David Brooke.
It's an honour, it's a privilege, and it's a great occasion today as we welcome the one and only, the legend. Some people might not recognise you without an umpire's hat on, but the one and only Maria Erasmus. Thank you very much for joining us here.
Thank you for the invitation.
How are you?
I'm good. A little rushed after day one of a truncated day, but yeah, all good.
You've come straight from a domestic four-day match. You've had years of international experience, but somehow there's still the love there of officiating in a four-day domestic match.
They're testing the love. this is my last four-day game, actually. I've got two more domestic 50-over games left after this. Yeah, so once I retired from international cricket, I promised Cricket South Africa I'll do two more seasons and just umpiring with the next generation guys. And yeah, so that's what I've been doing the last two seasons.
I've seen you in your transition from elite umpire back into domestic cricket, and it does seem like there's a intention to grow the next generation. There seems to be a new crop of youngsters coming through umpires in South Africa.
I think there's a good strong group currently, but I sort of learned a lesson when I was a young international umpire of guys retiring and sort of just disappearing. And the old umpiring mate of mine, Murray Brown, who's sadly passed, we discussed a little, and I said I'm gonna try and not make the same mistake, and you have to give something back because they looked after me initially, Cricket South Africa, and to get me to all over the world. So yeah, it was payback time.
It's fantastic to have you back in South Africa, and umpiring in the South African domestic game is the richer for it. And we'll talk about your umpiring career, but I really want to, it's not often that we get this opportunity to have an interview with a world-class legend umpire. But not a lot of people might know that you had a excellent first-class career, provincial career, before you turned an umpire. Just take us through that. Where did it start for you? Where did you play? Tell us some stories from back in the day.
Yeah, at school level, I was a decent player, but never got close to Western Province schools. I grew up in Bellville and played at TFLNI. Then went to military service and played club cricket, and then went to Paarl Teachers College in Paarl. And then I got picked for the Bulls on a 23 side. And then the first time I really thought, but maybe I'm not that bad. Maybe I can do it. And then when I moved on to Stellenbosch to study in after my teaching diploma, study at Stellenbosch University, I played for Funastel, and a couple of months later got picked to play for Boland. I was 2 months short of 25, and I remember Omar Henry being my first captain, and my first match was in Windhoek of all places, playing SA Defence in a three-day match. And Omar asked me, how old are you? And I said, I'm nearly 25. He said, it's a pity you're starting so late. And that was such motivation for me. I'll show you guys. And anyway, so played nine seasons of first-class cricket after that. But I was still playing rugby at the same time as well. So in 1991, I actually played seven matches rugby for Boland as well in the old Santam League in the Currie Cup B section. And I think I'm only one of seven who played first-class rugby and cricket for Boland.
A wing, naturally.
I was fly off 30 years and 30 kilograms ago. I played one game fly off and six fullback. And funny enough, my debut was in Sasselburg playing Ball Triangle on the Friday night. And this is 1991, so pre-cell phones and all of those things. Mm-hmm. And then we flew back on the Saturday morning. And Monday, I'm going back to work. It's the first year that I was teaching in 1991. And I thought, let's just get the newspaper, because the following day, Boland is supposed to play Free State in the first round of the old Lion Cup knockout. So I just want to check, you know, what's our team like? Only to find that I was dropped after my opening game. I was not in. But 2 weeks later, they had an injury and they summoned me to come to the last half an hour of practice. And I played six more matches at fullback for...
It does seem that era, we had Peter Kirsten on the show in the previous episode, and there does seem to be that your era, like there was this rugby cricket combination. You don't often see that these days.
Yeah, the seasons were obviously, you know, very regimented in 6 months in brackets. But, you know, total amateur, the rugby, I think we got 50 rand for the week, and that was for your petrol. Obviously, professional rugby only started in 1995. But even though my cricket career span first class was 88 to 97, I only had a contract once we got promoted to the A section, and it was 2,000 rand a month plus match fee. So yeah. I was a full-time teacher in those days, and I was just lucky that I had a headmaster who understood, you know, I can play, or be valuable for the school as a role model to the kids. And he gave me time off. He actually, in 1995, said to me, you should go play cricket in England as well. And I got a contract, but then got injured. And then in 1996, we organized that I get leave for 6 months from the education department. And I went to play cricket in Birmingham, which was fantastic experience.
That's a long 6 months. That's a long leave.
Yeah. In those days, you could have a term off after 5 years.
Okay.
But it was supposedly for study.
Okay.
But yeah, I went to study some other things in England. But, you know, my wife went with for about 3 months of the five. And then funny enough, in 2009, when I first time then went back to umpire, my teammates then were all obviously retired from playing. But yeah, we met up and had golf days and was... fantastic.
So you had a decent first class career from a cricketing point of view. I looked at some of your old scorecards. I mean, you gotta love those old scorecards. You see some crazy things and who you played with. And it struck me that some of your old teammates, the Salek Nakhadins and those kind of guys, would have been coaches when you were now umpiring their team. That must have been strange going from. But there's obviously a respect there. But it's nice to see everyone go in different directions.
Yeah, I think that the value of former first-class players going into umpiring is that the players themselves, because when I started, my first-class game was about 2003. So there were still many players who played against me. So they knew at least this guy has got a playing pedigree. They understand that, yes, he will make an error, but he knows cricket. So I think there's an acceptance slightly better. Doesn't say that if you didn't play first-class cricket, you can't be a great umpire. Simon Telfer is a great example. Didn't play first-class cricket. Best ever in the world. But I do think there's plenty of advantages. And in our current system, we've got guys like Brad White and Dennis Smith and many others that's following. One of the players today, I won't mention his name, it might put pressure on him, but today he's on the field. He spoke about umpiring to me. So it's definitely a thing that happened in England in county cricket all the time. And it's definitely happening in South Africa.
How do we, as South Africa, how do we rate in terms of youngsters or players coming to the end of their careers, transitioning into umpiring compared to the rest of the world? Are we right up there? It does seem to be that we have a steady flow of young guys coming through.
Well, currently we've got two guys on the elite panel. So I retired 2 years ago, and now Adrian Alstock and Aluddin Palliker are elite umpires. But an example of the fact that we are in the mix and on par with the rest is at under 19 World Cup level, Babs Gumar just stood the final again.
Yes.
And if you just go back to the last 4 or 5 editions of the 19 World Cup, our umpires are always in the finals. So maybe it's because our team is not always in the final. But our guys are definitely rated highly. And I think the first 4 years of SA20, where we only use domestic umpires, apart from the English guys, where we've got the exchange program with them, and some of our guys go there. But the first four editions, umpiring was a non-issue. No one spoke about umpiring. That means the guys were brilliant. And yeah, I think that answers your question. We've got a very, very strong group. They put a lot of money in. They've got coaches and resources. And so that's maybe why the product is good.
Take me through a journey of an umpire, in not just in South Africa, but relevant to South Africa or around the world. What does a youngster, girl, boy, do to get into umpiring?
Yeah. I mean, I can take my career as an example. I started with Boland Umpires Association and doing club cricket on Saturdays. In those days, Cricket South Africa had a fast-track system where they took guys that they thought, you know, could become successful, mainly former first-class players. So I got opportunities in my I was umpiring for 3 months. They sent me to the Universities Week, where in those days a lot of first-class cricketers participated in the Universities Week. So it was good cricket. And then within 3 years, I was doing first-class cricket in South Africa. You know, some other guys might take a little longer because they have to learn the nuances. We always say to be a good umpire, you need to be a good person. We're all trying to be good people. I'm not saying I'm a great person, but there's a value system. And then there are obviously skills that you have to have. Understanding the flow of a cricket match is very important. If they set a certain feel, I know what length they're going to bowl. And so you know, you're ready. Obviously, T20 cricket, there's always the uneventful or the super eventful, maybe. Things happening in the reverse sweeps and all kinds of things. So you need to be aware that even though you know sort of where this plan is going, there might be something different. Yeah, so I think one of my greatest natural skills that I had is that I've got I am a very calm person. So much so that my heart rate was so slow that I had to get a pacemaker about it 7 years ago, because my colleagues at the ICC level say, well, it's because he doesn't have a heart. but that's a strength. In under severe pressure, I could stay calm and you know, keep focused. So yeah, that was an advantage for me. Yeah, so it's club cricket. Hopefully go to tournaments, be seen. They do have a pathway where there's coaches in each of these provinces where they identify guys. Those identified umpires would go to tournaments, go to sessions where they get prepared, interaction with coaches that's employed by Cricket South Africa. It's not just, you know, like the old days, you rock up and you're sort of on your own.
Yeah.
There's a good structure.
I suppose that's where even, you know, youth weeks and stuff, it's not just for the players. It's actually to train the next generation of umpires. You're not going to get Maria Erasmus standing in schools SA20, for example, you know, something like that.
No, it's a stepping stone tournament for the next generation umpires.
Speaking just from naivety and not understanding it, are there exams? Are there fitness tests? Are there mental tests? Are there psychometric tests? What goes into to all of those?
Not kind of all of that, but the law exams, you actually do all of your exams before you're a first-class umpire. Once you're a first-class umpire, you don't have to do any written exams.
Okay.
But they do, like, they get weekly quizzes to keep them, you know, up to standard with the changes. Obviously, there's a lot of law changes, and since 2008 when IPL started and DRS started, the laws have changed a lot. There's quite a few new subtle changes, but coming into the laws in October this year. So, you know, all umpires have to keep up to date with those. So, I've never done any psychometric tests, but I think being an umpire coach is probably the most difficult job in cricket, because obviously you need to know all the technicalities of umpiring, but then you need to babysit these guys, because, you know, if we have a bad day, we want to cry on someone's shoulder. So, yeah, you have to be a psychologist as well, a motivator, and
what happened? I mean, even the best umpires in the world, such as yourself, you have bad days, and you're sitting in the middle of Bangladesh there, and it's just you and the other three umpires and match referee that you're with. What does Maria Erasmus do after a day like that?
Yeah. Thank goodness for technology nowadays where you can video call and things like that to speak to the family maybe. But I can tell you, after two test matches, I got elevated to the elite panel. So I'm thinking, you know, I know umpiring. I can do this. So my first test as an elite umpire is England playing Pakistan in Birmingham, where I played club cricket, so all my friends are in the stand. And the first session before lunch, I had three appeals and I was 0 from 3. I got all three wrong. Two were reviewed. Obviously, I had to change my decisions. The other one, the batter thought he was out, but he was actually struck outside line. I came back in that test match and I got 27 out of 30 right. And the match ref wrote on my report, after a very slow start, Maria made a remarkable recovery. Anyway, so those are the evenings where you're alone in the hotel and you think, oh, you know, I've just got a one-year contract. Am I going to be good enough to do this? I've left my job. I've committed totally to umpiring. Yeah. Mm. So those are pressures. And if you in Birmingham, it's not the worst place to be. But yeah, if you're in other venues and you've been away for a long time, then it can be a challenging. And I think in the end, with me of doing this for 18 years, in the end, I just didn't want to be away anymore.
Mm.
But I mean, if you're at 45 and you feel that way, you might just hang in because it's financial. I was luckily 60 at the time, so it was sort of end for me.
It's something that I've always wanted to ask an umpire. And, you know, you won the ICC umpire of the year for 3 years in your career, which is a prestigious award, obviously the top award for an umpire. But this might sound stupid, but what makes a good umpire? Like, what makes you win it over somebody else?
Yeah, it's a difficult question because there's many ways to be a good umpire, and you must always umpire within your character. The guys will say, "Oh, I must." No, I said, "Just I be like who you are. Just be who you are." Ian Gould and myself, we umpired many tests together, and it was, you know, we are totally different characters. We did a few Boxing Day test matches together. And when he retired, they asked him, so who's the guys you enjoyed umpiring with? And my name came up and he said, you know, the two of us are totally different. He says on Christmas Day, day before Boxing Day obviously starts, we both leave the hotel at the same time. Marie goes to church and I go to the pub. But on the field, we just gelled. Rod Tucker and myself, we got on the panel at the same time.
Mm.
And, you know, we didn't actually stand that many tests together, but it was just, we always just got on. Mm. I wouldn't say that I, you know, didn't get on with many of my colleagues, but there were other guys that sometimes, if you have a test match with him, it was harder work, you know, just maybe from a social point of view, because you might be alone, because he's not someone that goes out in the evening or different challenges like that. But, I think there's many ways to be a good umpire.
Mm. It's not just on stats. It's not just on...
Oh, sorry, yeah. Like, to get to that.
Yeah.
There's about 5 or 6 different sections where they evaluate you.
Mm.
Obviously, for the cricket watcher, it's all about decisions.
Yeah.
if you have a good year and decision-making, then you've got a good chance to be the umpire of the year. The captains also vote, so there's a bit of emotion. So it's the match refs and the captains that vote. Some years you would be ranked number one by the ICC, but maybe not win the award because there's a bit of an emotion in the voting process. But luckily enough, I was...
It's always subjective when it comes to captains. If they win the match, you're the best umpire in the world. They forget about the shocker that you made in the first innings.
They don't, their umpire reports at ICC level does not count for my contract.
Oh, really?
So that's,
okay.
But they do get a vote once a year for the umpire of the year.
Yeah.
So luckily we've got that. But in all other cricket, club cricket and domestic cricket, we don't have enough resources. The streaming quality of the product is not good enough.
Mm.
So you have to have the captain's reports as part of that.
Mm.
And it's emotional for both parties sometimes.
So what would constitute a good year in terms of decision making? How many, what percentage would you need to get right for a good year?
Okay, my best year was, I was 98, but that was a freakish year. But it's normally around 94, 95 is a good year. The average is about 92.
At elite level, the average is 92. Wow. 92.
And it's actually gone down because technology is getting better. So even though my neatest little edge is now, now goes as an error. Whereas in the previous generation umpires, those were correct decisions. Technology couldn't find it.
I wanted to actually ask you about technology. And one of the questions I want to ask you is, have we gone too far with technology or not far enough?
It's very close of going too far. But now let's take the 2020 leagues. Now they're checking full tosses. Over, and those were skills that the best umpires had and got correct 99% of the time. It's very interesting that the expectation from coaches and players and captains are that the umpires must be perfect. Yet they bowl wides and out volleys and play across the line. It's a game by humans. Umpiring should, that human element should always be there. So it's maybe we've gone too far, but the genie is out the bottle. It's not going to change.
That's a good way.
And the money involved in these leagues, obviously they want it to be as accurate.
There's a drama effect to it, I suppose,
The sad part of it is actually that the cricket that most of us watch is maybe, 2% of cricket played in the world. What about the school leagues and the clubs? Now there's an expectation from a school kid that this poor umpire, who was probably forced by the headmaster to take the sting, must be that good. He can't be that good. And many times I get a call from disgruntled parent and said, but this guy, this umpire had a provincial badge on his chest. Now maybe he borrowed the shirt from someone. if he gets appointed to school cricket and they've appointed the best guys to club cricket, he might be the 40th best in Western Province of Borland or Gauteng. But he's giving up his Saturday, so it's tough. But maybe, it doesn't seem to me that they're stopping. They're just adding more things that they're going to check. And then what is the umpire going to do? Count to six?
So, I mean, it sounds a bit far-fetched, but is it far-fetched to say that, tennis has done it, where they've done away with linesmen. It's automated now when the ball's out. If there isn't a recording of some voice going out or let, etc. Could we see a stage in cricket, maybe not in your time, but maybe in years to come, where there's no standing umpires on the field?
Yeah. Some of these matches, you need to be an adjudicator, peacemaker maybe. Maybe it's not going to be about cricket.
You need to be a referee.
Just maybe managing people. I don't know. I hope not. I hope not.
You had to manage some high-profile matches. You've managed T20 World Cup finals, 50-over World Cup finals, Women's World Cup finals. But the one that stands out is obviously the 2019 World Cup final, England versus New Zealand, that dramatic super-over. Murray Erasmus is in the thick of things. Ben Stokes is lying on the ground. He's just got a ball hitting his bat as he's diving and it goes for four. What goes through an umpire's mind is like, could this not have just been a six off the final over to win and that easy win? What goes through your mind at that stage?
In the moment, you don't think. You are so focused that sometimes someone would bowl a fantastic spell and it weren't registered. The next day you think, that guy really bowled well. So, but because we concentrate on so many other things. But that's particular game. Obviously, the error we made by avoiding six and not five for the overthrow. After the game, everybody shook our hands and no one mentioned that. No one realized that. It was only overnight that someone in Australia saw, but that was a technical error.
It's not like the Aussies to pick up on something.
And the next morning I opened my door on my way to breakfast and Kumar Damasino stood with me. His room was, and he opens the door and says, Did you see? I said, see what? He says, we made an error. And then this dawned onto us. That was an epic game. Still my highlight, even though it was an unfortunate error. But Trent bowled took a catch and nonchalantly, you know, could have avoided stepping on, I believe. And Jimmy Neeson actually bowled the ball from my end, and we didn't have auto no ball in those days. And there was one that I thought, I wonder if that wasn't a no ball. So I asked Rod Tucker, the TV umpire, I said, that last one. And he said, it was a good non-call. It was sort of heel on the line. So technically that was also a no ball.
Yeah.
You know, there was a wide called in one of the super overs that wasn't a wide, but it was called. These things happen.
That's the nuances of
that is what it is. Yeah. And with the error we made where Ben Stokes was then on strike again, Adil Rashid, it should have been five, and Adil Rashid should have been on strike, number 10 batter. But he's got 10 first-class hundreds. Who says he didn't hit the next ball over extra cover for four? So ifs and buts.
And that's what we all love about cricket, that it creates podcast episodes like this where we can talk about it. And England are sitting with a World Cup in their cabinet. And just some of the other matches that you've, you know, women's cricket in particular, when you first started your career, international cricket probably wasn't, it was nowhere near what it is today. How has that been on the field in terms of the professionalism of the players themselves on the field when you first started umpiring women's cricket to what it is today?
I only ever umpired 18 women's matches in my life. They're all at World Cups.
So I never
No, it was just, it just how it happened. We had a few of those T20 World Cups where the men and the women competition was at the same venue.
Yeah.
And that's how I managed to umpire those games. In 29 in England, I only did a warm-up game, ladies, but 2010, I did the final in Barbados, and then 12 and 14 in Bangladesh and in Sri Lanka. But I remember in 9, it was only England, Australia and New Zealand that were any good, and none of the other teams were close to them. And then, you know, all these teams just picked up on it, and we, our own team, I think Momentum bought into it, and starting giving contracts to the ladies, and you know, now we've been in World Cup finals and just how many years? 15 years.
Yeah.
So things can change. And if you think India ladies are good, they are now.
Yeah.
They were nowhere in 2010. And the West Indies were supreme athletes, but you know, they were a bit raw in 2009, and I think in 2012 or 14 they also won with both the men and the women won.
Yeah.
Unfortunately it was Ben Stokes who felt the pain.
Well, unfortunately.
I really like him as
a person. He's an absolute legend. And
I'll tell you a story about him.
Yeah.
Stuart Broad and Jimmy Anderson, they were just hard work. And they wouldn't even greet you when we go to practices. Really? You know, we stand in the net and get our eye in. And he, Ben Stokes, is the kind of guy that would come to you, come shake your hand and ask you, how's your family? You know, so to me, I've lots of time for him. Maybe not for the other two.
It's interesting you say that about, and thanks for bringing that up, about the net. Not many people just think umpires rock up on the day of a match. At the game starts at 10, they rock up at 9, they drive in and they go on the field. Give us a lead up to a test match. What happens?
Yeah, so if I get appointed to say tests in England in early June, I would know this, say, in March already. Obviously, throughout the year, you would need to have some physical fitness. So I used to run until I was about 45, and then I started doing some cycling because of Achilles and heel problems, etc. I made sure that I'm reasonably fit, because test cricket is physically hard. It's mentally, obviously, super tough, but it's also physically hard. And then we have a video library, so there's things and assess. We have a coach that it's appointed, so if there's something you're struggling, you can discuss with that person. And then physically we're there 4 days before the test match starts, and we go to at least two, or maybe sometimes three practices. Depends how big was your gap between your last test, and if you may be unfamiliar with the conditions, you do more prep work. But it's also an opportunity to build bridges with players, you know, helping with no balls, whatever. Just getting to know someone. Maybe watch a spinner that you've never seen before.
Okay.
Does he bowl the googly?
Yeah.
Does he bowl a arm ball? You know, things like that.
And the teams don't mind you rocking. I mean, do you, is there communication? Like, do you say?
No. They know. It's been, this practice has been going on for years.
Yeah.
So they know the umpires come, and then they accommodate us. Yeah. And then every series will start with this pre-series meeting between the match ref, us, and the teams. Initially, we used to have it together, but then there was, if there's something that the captain of England wants to ask about a player that they may be worried about on the opposition, then that wasn't the forum. So now we do it separately, so those things can be discussed. And then it's just, you know, go through expectations and maybe changing laws or playing condition and things like that. That's a lot of preparation goes into it. And you know, we've paid full time. So yeah, you need to put the work in.
Is there a little superstition or a routine or just something that you do as like a little good luck, every test match? Do you wear the same socks or?
No. I do have a sort of, to set myself up. So before every ball, I would just, there's a line that I'd made myself. Some guys paint lines. I just make a line with my shoe as we start. And sometimes I will just use my foot and just draw that line again. So that was sort of, okay, I'm in it. Here we go. And if I leave my position and come back, I'll just draw the line again with my foot.
And how sick of hotel breakfast are you? Yeah. Over the years.
Yeah, now when my wife says, oh, we need to go away, I said, do we have to? You know? I suppose, you know, she committed to this lifestyle and it's payback time.
Yeah. Is there something that I remember listening to a podcast episode interview with Faf du Plessis, and he said that the one thing playing in all these leagues around the world, and he used to do something that he would bring something from home that would make his hotel room bearable for those 3 months that he was maybe at IPL. Was there anything that you would take, your own coffee machine or your own beer mug or something?
I traveled with the South African flag, always had the South African flag me. And then I was in Dunedin and went to watch a super rugby match where the Bulls played. I would never own a Bulls flag, but I took my South African flag and put it out in front of me. And they were down 20-0 at halftime. So that was, you know, for supporting the Bulls. that was a payment, the payback I got. So I folded up my South African flag. I said, I felt embarrassed about this.
Yeah.
But apart from that, then obviously, you know, some South African and especially Afrikaans music on my phone. So when you do make all those errors, and then you can maybe listen to a bit of Steve Offmay.
I was just going to say.
To get you back.
I was just going to say, what is on Marais Erasmus? This wasn't on my notes to ask, but what
I'm
is
a Neil Marais Diamond Erasmus? Fan. Yeah, no.
What's on Marais Erasmus's playlist?
No, anything, you know, even ABBA. But all the latest Afrikaans stuff, Spoegwolf and all those guys are.
Nice.
Yeah.
You've obviously done a hell of a lot of travel in your day and racked up some air miles, but you obviously you do get to enjoy whichever country you're in. Is there been Olympic Games around times where you've been traveling, or World Cup football, anything like that, where you've experienced Wimbledon, something like that?
Yeah, I saw myself as a good tourist, and I mean, I was a history and geography teacher in my younger days. So I really enjoyed, you know, going to museums and, you know, experiencing the local stuff. I love traveling in India. The trips mustn't be too long, because it can be, sometimes challenging. But I, you know, went to the Taj Mahal and, you know, in Delhi and all those old city and all those things. Sporting events, I went to Wimbledon, I went to Grand Prix Athletics, I went to a premiership match. I went to see Premiership Rugby final at Twickenham, London Sevens twice.
Amazing.
Best day ever, I would say, is Wimbledon.
Yeah.
I had a Friday ODI at the Oval and a Sunday one at Lord's, and I swapped my Lord's tickets with a tennis coach that a friend of mine knew.
Yeah.
And we got centre court tickets on the Saturday.
Royal box?
Not quite the Royal box, but it was the middle Saturday where, is it Sue Barker from BBC, introduced all, you know, the sporting legends
there. Yeah. The previous
Phil,
champions?
Phil Tufnell, I think, was there that year. And then, had to sneak out of Wimbledon about 9:30 that evening.
Mm.
Some of the matches that still was going on because I was standing at Lord's the next day. So maybe not the best preparation.
Yeah. From a stadium point of view, I mean, Lord's must have been to stand. I mean, the way that they treat everyone from players to umpires is just different level compared to any.
I was very lucky that I think I stood 6 test matches on field there and a couple others, TV umpire, and then obviously the World Cup final there in 2019. Also did my 100th first class match there and my 50th test match there. So, yeah, those are coincidences, but yeah, good ones.
Have you got a painting up there yet of you?
No.
Not yet.
I don't think it's going to happen. you know, maybe membership. Wink, wink.
Nigel, we'll put it out there and we'll tag the MCC and... that's cool, eh?
Yeah, no, but it is just a fantastic place. You rightly say how they treat you.
Mm.
There's always a little gift that you get with a test match.
Mm.
The lunches are phenomenal. Yeah. So
you like
you run because it's like steak and caviar.
What were some of the differences between umpiring in, say, Australia versus India versus England?
Yeah, I think every venue, there's different challenges. If you get to England in June, those pitches can be very sporting. So you need to understand, you know, nip and bounce and swing and get your angles right. But at the same stage, similar thing applies to a spinning wicket in Mumbai or Kolkata. I did find Sri Lanka the most difficult place because that spun and bounce, where England would just spin but reasonably low. So if you get your angle right, you know it's going to hit the stumps. But the worst test I ever had, I made 6 errors in Palakkale in Sri Lanka. My partner beat me. He made 11. The next test, on field, I won't mention his name. I was TV umpire, and we got a message from the director that he's missing a few no balls. So I sent him a message. I said, listen, watch the front line. He says, I don't care about the front line. I can't get the other side right. Yeah, so you can imagine these mental games.
Yeah.
And one stage in that test match, after play, he said to me, you know, when they appeal in that millisecond, through my mind goes, if I give it out, it's going to be not out. If I say not out, it's going to be out.
Yeah.
Now, if you are, you know, sitting with that baggage at that, then you, it's a tough day. But this happens and it snowballs. So, yeah, that was the only game that I really sort of freaked out.
Is it more challenging, like, do certain umpires have trouble with left arm bowlers, like, over the wicket? Or, like, is that a thing in umpiring?
Early on in my career, one of the coaches said, but you, looking at your error rate, your LBWs are the most errors. And I said, listen, I'm a bit of a statistician. So what number of my appeals were LBW appeals? He says, no, you know, 80-odd% is of your appeals. I said, but it's only like 50% of my errors.
Mm.
So I don't have an LBW problem. I might actually have a caught behind problem
because
I'm getting a higher number of that actually incorrect.
Yeah.
But if you umpire in a stadium where there's 50,000 people, you're not going to get those faint necks.
Yeah.
So, can I?
I mean, it's mind-blowing to actually think that, I mean, I've been to IPL and the noise from the crowd is just, it's indescribable.
Yeah, you have to understand body language and take a couple of calculated guesses. Let's call them guesses because you're not hearing it, but you've got to feel that was out. And some of your colleagues, if they know you well, and you give one out and you know, we always get together, then they say, it was a good guess.
They know when you...
They know.
Yeah.
So it's challenging.
Mm.
I did have, I wouldn't say out of body experience, but it was this weird experience. Mm. I was umpiring India-Pakistan in a round robin game in Melbourne, 93,000 people.
Ooh.
And that night I heard every nick. It was just weird.
Mm.
And I think if you are so focused, you can cut off other noises. It was a game which Virat Kohli won for India.
Mm.
But late in the game, we had a high full toss. Now, we are coached, if a high full toss gets hit in the air, not to commit to your call. So you made your call mentally, but you don't commit to the call, because if it does get caught, it can be reviewed.
Yeah.
Because on a dismissal, we can review anything.
Yeah.
But if it lands, then, or it goes for six, then you need to. So now the ball gets bowled, it is close, and he hits the ball out, and there's a Pakistani guy on the boundary. So now I'm waiting, either to be caught or go for six. And when it went for six, I put my arm out. Now the Pakistanis are upset with me, because by then, obviously, Virat has got his arms out.
Yeah.
They think he's you know, pushing me into this decision.
Mm.
But Babar Azam, I met when he was 15 years old at a tournament in West Indies.
Mm.
And I just walked to him and I explained to him, we have to wait because the ball potentially could be. And he said, okay, thanks. And he turned around and he walked away.
Mm.
And the whole crowd went silent. So, you know, those players are massive influence.
Yeah.
And if they, you know, stir up the emotions of the crowd, it's a dangerous situation for potentially an umpire. And, you know, if some of these nations turn on you, or the administrators turn on you, then that might be the end of your career.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you about those kind of big egos on the field. There's a charisma to those kind of guys, the Kohlis, the Stokes, you know, those kind of big names. But how important is it to have that rapport with those kind of guys? Because they are, as you say, they can settle a crowd. They can simmer down a situation that was at boiling point.
Mm. I just try to be fair to everyone. Mm. You know, first game or 100th game, doesn't matter. And especially with the captains. Mm. You know, be hard but fair with them.
Mm.
Virat is a lovable boy but he's so emotional. And he was like, I was thinking of my teaching days when you had this kid where, you know, you want to kill him six times a day, but you also want to give him a hug at the end of the day. And he was that character. And he was always very apologetic because, you know, he's over the line and then you speak to him, I'm sorry, Murray, I'm sorry.
Mm.
But the next ball is there again. So you had to have a bit of patience with him. But yeah, he was very clever that he always, similar to the Aussies who target the best player, he always targeted the best player. And I remember Stokes lost it in Mohali when he chirped him once he was dismissed. And we couldn't hear what Virat said, but Stokes, he was swearing so loudly we had to punish him. you know, that's clever. Just put the bait out.
I mean, there must have been, I mean, we could talk for hours about kind of stories and stuff like that, but has there ever been a moment, well, there's been moments where you've had to really not massage the situation, where you had to step in and physically say, like, cool off, you know, in harsher words. Like, just give us one scenario.
Well, I think my calm demeanor helped in those situations, and the fact that my frame is quite big. So when I stepped in, some of these guys sort of knew, okay, that's enough now.
Yeah.
But in Nottingham in 2011, Praveen Kumar, medium pacer, couldn't speak a word of English. Kevin Peterson on strike. Kevin Peterson walks down the wicket, but then it hits him on the shin. So now Praveen is appealing for LBW, expecting to be given.
Mm.
But I mean, it would be such guesswork for me if this guy is now 3 meters down. And in that particular series, we didn't have DRS for LBWs.
Mm.
It was before India committed fully to DRS.
Yeah.
But we could have DRS for court behinds. So now they just have to accept my decision. It did show umpire's call on height. So even though it hit him on the shin, you know, it was hitting the stumps high because of the travelling distance. But in that test match, Stuart Broad gets a hat-trick. And the middle wicket is an inside edge LBW that I miss, and I give out Harbhajan Singh.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't need ball tracking, which they didn't trust in those days. You just could look at the video and see the inside edge.
Yeah.
But the decision stuck, and then he bowled the next guy for the hat-trick ball.
Yeah.
So yeah, Stuart Broad scored a hat-trick, and I kept on showing it and kept on obviously highlighting my error. And that night, his dad, Chris, who was a match ref and worked with us, early in the week, he invited us to his house for dinner. So I walked into Chris Broad's house with two bottles of wine in the afternoon. I gave his son
he maybe should have greeted you at the next joint
ball. Yeah, so anyway, I was just thinking afterwards, and it was a bit foolish because maybe some Indian reporter came to Chris's house and yeah, I'm walking in with two bottles of wine. But yeah, Chris did have a toast on me for giving Stewart a hat trick.
Yeah. Listen, you had a couple of other hat tricks, you'll be okay. You know, we're coming towards the end. I mean, as I said, we could talk for hours and stuff, but a couple more questions which I really need to ask you about. And just like the governance and the kind of the anti-corruption is so crucial to the compliance, the game, the integrity of the game in world cricket, in South African cricket, in world cricket. How do they protect umpires from the scrutiny and the approaches and those kind of the negative side of any sport?
You know, we go through the same training as the players, and I think we should be actually better. We are slightly more mature in years than some of the players, so maybe you know, we should be handling it better. I was lucky I was never approached by anyone, but you know, some of my colleagues and maybe umpires I didn't even know, guys who did some of the domestic leagues were approached, and you know, some fell for it and got banned. So it's unfortunately still a big thing in cricket, and therefore so much resources are put into it, and anti-corruption officers, as you know, is at every tournament, and to get credibility as a tournament, you have to have those things in place. So yeah, I think the education for umpires and the players will have to continue, because unfortunately, you know, there's so much money out there, and you know, people are still going to be tempted.
In terms of South African umpires, SA20 has obviously come around in the last 4 years, and the umpires have been heroed a little bit more. It's not just about domestic cricket, is a level up now from domestic cricket. How important has that evolution been for the umpires from a professionalism point of view? Because it does seem that there's now a level in between domestic cricket and international cricket that can prepare a local umpire a little bit better.
Definitely, and there's many more opportunities under 19 World Cups and you know, other domestic leagues that guys get to go to. Whereas maybe 20 years ago, you would only find one guy is really elite level in your domestic system. But now we've got like really two on. A guy like Arno Jacobs, I think, is fantastic in potential. He could be an elite umpire. So, and there's guys, Babs Kumar just stood on the 19 World Cup. So these guys, Stephen Harris, Bongani Jele, they're all doing international cricket, doing so well. So who says maybe in another 4 or 5 years they can't be elite umpires? So yeah, we've got a strong base, and that exposure, like SA20, obviously, you know, suddenly sees, or they can see what the expectations needed to be successful. Obviously, not all will be successful, but yeah, some are now, you know, the whole world is watching SA20, and they can see, well, these guys are quality umpires.
Going around to other leagues, not just SA20, going around to other leagues, every league's got different playing conditions. You know, the 100's got their nuances. You know, every Major League Cricket's got theirs, SA20's got theirs. How difficult is it as an umpire to go, okay, I'm in England at the moment, I'm at the 100, these are the things I need to, you can't call it an over anymore. It's a set, you know, those kind of things. Like, how difficult is that?
No, it is challenging, but you know, one or two games and then you're in it. The last 2 years I went umpired at Major League Cricket. The first year, their second year is a tournament. My first year there, I was on field, and then this in 2025 I went as a TV umpire. But it was more about spending time with their umpires, you know, off the field, just playing a part there. Simon Telfer is involved in that league, as he is with ILT20, and he's playing another role of, you know, bringing umpires to the fore. Leslie Reefer, who stood last night, gave a brilliant LB decision. He was at Major League Cricket. He's from the West Indies. So all these things prepare you for the big time.
But now, so I've heard that Murray Rasmus loves his golf. Is that now something that you are looking forward to? Now that you are winding down that finger from... Firstly, I need to ask you, and it's something we spoke about earlier, was how does an umpire come up with their signature dismissal? Did you train for that? Did you think about it? Did you see it somewhere? No. Is there a method in
your practice? And to me, that was just natural. I was told by a coach at one stage I should give them out more aggressively, and I said, I think they get the message. It doesn't matter. Cyril Mitchley was more aggressive in the way he gave it.
Yeah.
Mine was just a matter of fact finger. There you go.
There you know. Yeah, you know.
But yeah, I'm really passionate about golf.
Have you always played, or is it something you picked up?
I started playing at college level, but then as a teacher, you know, teacher's time is so precious, and you know, my family was young then. So when I became a full-time umpire, I started playing more. So from 2008 onwards, I started playing more.
Nice.
And I can brag a little. On Saturday, I played against some Irish guys who was visiting Hermanus. And after three holes, I looked at the 76-year-old five handicapper, and I said, you must have been a hell of a player in your youth. Were you a plus player? And he just smiled at me. I said, did you play on the European tour? And he said, yes. But he retired in 1975 from the European Tour. So that's just more than 50 years ago. But I beat him 3-2.
Here we go.
Yeah. So no, I love golf.
Nice. I suppose it's a very lekker outlet for you.
Yeah.
Nobody can bother you for 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah. I mean, now living in Hermanus, you know, 27-hole golf course there. You know, pristine condition. So yeah, it's a nice outing twice a week.
Before we get into our final section where we're going to ask you some fun quickfire questions, what's next for Maria Erasmus? You're obviously winding down your domestic. I know you're going to miss standing in 35 degree heat at Boylan Park there in a first division match.
Yeah, I know. I obviously, you know, it's going to be done in March on field. I'm not planning to be an umpire coach or anything like that, but maybe, you know, Stephen Cook has mentioned that he'll contact me in the winter, and then maybe, you know, play some other advisory role at, you know, whatever leagues, maybe with Cricket South Africa. I don't want to be spending time away from home too much anymore. You know,
can we ask your wife that same question?
Yeah, no, she's, you know, desperate for me to be at home, I'm sure. And then, you know, I was involved in more than 800 professional games. So enough is enough.
I was looking at the numbers. You've literally spent over 2 years on the field of play, whether it's TV umpire or standing umpire. That's a hell of a long time.
No, it's a long time. And I was lucky, you know, to experience far more. My first goal when I started umpiring was, I played 53 first-class games, and I thought, you know, if I can umpire a few more than what I played, and, you know, this is my 148th that I've just started first-class game, and it's like, I don't know, it feels like 2,000 T20 games, because that's what's happened since 2008 in IPL. But, I mean, IPL has been fantastic financially for everyone.
Umpires included.
You know, we went there, and suddenly they're paying you $4,000 a game, which is, you know, ridiculous. But some of the other leagues, you know, want to pay the guys $50 a match. Yeah, that also backfired, because of that particular tournament long time ago. Had lots of corruption there.
I remember when the IPL first started, there was... the umpires had to ask permission, if I'm not mistaken. They weren't contracted by the ICC, or they... there was something at the start of the IPL.
You had to get clearance, players to have an NOC. We had to, and there were one or two times I couldn't do IPL because I had ICC commitments in that time.
So those trumped.
Now there's hardly any ICC cricket.
It's got a clear window now.
It's only probably Pakistan and Bangladesh that might be playing at the same time. Sometimes Sri Lanka, because some of their players have been cut from IPL. But the other nations don't play. And But I think I went to 9 IPLs. So all of that is, you know.
Some good memories, eh?
Some good memories. I feel really, you know, privileged. Obviously, you have to be a little bit a cricket nut to go into umpiring and, you know, be a... not that I felt the abuse terribly, because I'm not on any social media, so sorry, didn't read what you said about me. It didn't bother me. But yeah,
love it.
Once or twice people would say, you know, did you hear they said that? Well,
yeah.
Everybody has an opinion, and
yeah,
you know, mine's based on good knowledge of what umpiring is supposed to be, and maybe those guys with comments haven't got a clue anyway.
Maria, I mean, jeez, we can go on for hours, but I mean, you've just done a 4-day match here, so we're going to let you go. But before we go, I'm going to ask you some quick fire questions, just some fun, short answers. First question: if there was one rule in cricket that you had the power to change, what would it be?
I will bring the soft signal back. I think the when they took it away, and now it's an open agenda and everybody complains. At least we had parameters when we had the soft signal, and the teams understood that the TV umpire is working within those parameters. But yeah, so difficult to give with the cameras to give, you know, a three-dimensional situation a proper outcome.
I think players enjoyed the soft signal as well. It gave them, as you say, some...
You know, my comment to the guys that's involved in the rules committee is, I said, if you change something, it needs to be better. It's not better now. So I'm hoping for that to change back.
I like that. The best batsman and the best bowler that you've ever stood in front of. You get the best view in the house.
Obviously, I will have to be biased, and I'll say AB de Villiers. Obviously, I didn't stand him in a test, but I did two ODIs. And then Dale Steyn. I did a domestic game, a young Dale Steyn. By then, he had played a few tests for South Africa in Bloemfontein. And Bloemfontein had this grassy wicket, I don't know why, and he bowled for my end and took an 8-for, bowling at 145 and swinging it against a Knights team at the time, who had Puta Dipenaar, Morne van Wyk, Jacques Rudolph, you know, some class batsmen, and he bowled them out for nothing. And then the second innings, he took 6-for. So 14.
Nothing wrong with
wickets, and a quick game, of course. Quick game is a good game.
More golf. The craziest thing you've seen on or off the field of play?
I stood a game, domestic game at Newlands, where the mist came in, and the mist was so low it was below the floodlights. But we managed to finish the game.
Yeah.
I think if it was a Red Bull game, obviously we had no chance.
Okay, you might not be able to answer this, but your favorite umpire to travel with around the world and why?
Rod Tucker, also a golf lover.
Okay.
And a white wine drinker like myself. So, yeah.
Gotcha. That's a good enough why. Your favorite country to tour and why?
I like going to Australia and New Zealand, but my favorite cricketing destination was definitely England, because a couple of things. The cricket history, you know, as a kid in the 70s growing up, dreaming of going to play county cricket and things like that, never good enough to play county cricket, but now going to places like Lords and Nottingham and the Oval, just, you know, names that you just as a kid were dreaming about, and now I'm in those change rooms and, you know, walking through the long room. That is one of the most amazing experiences when those guys with their ties, and as you go from our change room is on the first floor behind the visiting team, and you walk down the stairs and you enter the long room, and one of the MCC staff would say, "Gentlemen, the umpires," and then they will give you a little, you know, clap. So that still, I still get goosebumps when
Then the final question: which bowler has had the worst, most excruciating, irritating appeal that you've ever umpired to? That even if it's out, you consider giving it not out because it's just so irritating.
There was an Aussie, I forget his name, he was a fast bowler. His brother played for Pattinson. His brother played for England. James appealed, and he appealed again, you know, and when he appealed the first time, I started shaking my head. And then I said, you know, one appeal's, you know, good enough. He says, but can't I appeal until you give it up? So I said, but I've already said not out, so I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah. So that's maybe just a bit of bowler logic.
Yeah, that's great. I like that one. Maria, just final question as we wrap up. How would you like the cricketing world in not just in South Africa to remember the name Maree Erasmus in 20 years' time?
Well, I said, you know, to be a good umpire, you have to be a good person. So hopefully they do remember as a good person. Very lucky to have done this, you know, to get paid. It's given me and my family so many, you know, massive privileges. So, yeah. Mm. Hopefully they do remember me.
Maree, you're an absolute legend. You're going to go into the Hall of Fame, not just the cricket, ICC Hall of Fame in South Africa and the Hall of Fame. You're a legend for being here this evening. Thank you so much for your service to world cricket, South African cricket in particular, and being inspiration for youngsters coming through, young umpires that you're standing with now. I'm sure it's an honour for them. They'll talk about the fact that they got to umpire with the great Maree Erasmus. To be able to sit here and have a Diet Coke, we'll say it on air that it's a Diet Coke, and a coffee with you has been an absolute honour and a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time. And it's wish you everything of the best and lots of golf and 27 holes in a minus. And hopefully your family will love having you home all the time. It's been an absolute honour. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Val.